And we're off. Everyone, thank you so much for coming. Kol hakavod lekulam. All the promos and the encouragement I see has worked. And also you came because you wanted to learn, which is really beautiful. Before I even start, a big thank you has to go to Matthew Fisher for putting together the entire program. Literally, from scratch, putting everything together, getting all the speakers, working, you know, at the last minute to make some beautiful posters, just to entice people a little bit more. And the work really, really shows. And now it's just up to us, the speakers, to follow through on the promises that we've made. Of course, after this, you can all purchase my book outside. I'll sign it for you on Kabbalah. You didn't know that I wrote one? Then you're right. It's definitely an interesting topic and a difficult one. It's difficult to learn about and it's difficult to speak about, especially when you're my age, frankly. But putting together this shiur, this lecture for you, has been an immense pleasure, both because I learned a lot, but also because I'm excited to share everything with you. I can guarantee you that you will not go out tonight without learning something. That I can guarantee. And what I hope to convey to all of you is a lot of things. Let me kind of give you an outline of what this class is going to be about. It's not going to go too deeply into any one single topic of Kabbalah. I leave that for the subsequent lectures and shiurim and to those with a little bit more expertise. My goal tonight is to help cover the main themes of Kabbalah, the history of Kabbalah. By the way, I may switch between Kabbalah and my native tongue, which is Kabbalah, which I'll apologize at the outset to those who it offends, but that's the way it is. And I know. And to cover a little bit of the history of Kabbalah throughout the ages, major Kabbalists, the major works of Kabbalah, a little bit maybe of some of the opposition to Kabbalah, although there will be a lecture later on specifically about that. And of course, I want to show how all of us are Kabbalistic Jews, whether you know it or not. So much of our practice, our liturgy, our learning, our belief system is predicated on mysticism, and specific Jewish mysticism, tefillah beyond anything else. And I hope to open up our eyes to some of that tonight. All right, so without further ado, let's get started. What is Kabbalah? Now, at this point, I'm not going to... Those of you who have learned with me know that I like to be a little bit interactive. I'll tell you when I want to be interactive. That was not a question I was asking you. That was rhetorical. What is Kabbalah? It's at the front of the... It's at the top of the sheet. And if you don't learn anything else, you'll learn at least three fancy English words tonight. Okay? Kabbalah is three things. There are three spheres of Kabbalah. Theopathy, theurgy, and theosophy. What are these three things? So we'll go in order of what's least familiar. Theopathy is basically the idea of transcending your physical existence, right? Usually through meditation. To reach a higher state of consciousness using meditation. People don't realize how much meditation is a part of Judaism. Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, who we will be citing a lot tonight, because he has written, I'll do a little bit of a bibliography of where all this stuff comes from a little bit later, but he wrote a book called Jewish Meditation, which actually had a big impact on me, because it showed how much meditation is a part of Judaism, and specifically, we do something every single day, which, according to Rabbi Kaplan, is a meditation, which is called, we do it three times a day, that's a dead giveaway. The Amidah specifically is supposed to be a form of meditation. When done properly, it's meant to alter your state of consciousness. Not with with drugs, chas v'shalom, but with thinking. And an extreme form of that is you know, transcendental meditation, which is a very, very big part of the Kabbalah. Kabbalah uses usually divine names, divine images, letters. There's a lot of letter meditation. Has anybody ever... Oh, I forgot the name of the movie now. It was a movie about a spelling bee. I know that sounds strange. Was it called Spelling Bee? It was called Spelling Bee. No, because there were a few that came out that year. And it was a movie called Spelling Bee. Richard Gere was in it, I remember. It was a book, originally. And the book and the story was about this girl who was entered into a spelling bee. And she had a father who was a professor of Kabbalah. And he specifically was a professor of meditative Kabbalah. He was studying, he was an expert in Avraham Abulafia, who we will get to soon, who was all about studying letters in Kabbalah, and he used it to help his daughter basically do well in the spelling bee. And it's a very, very interesting movie. There's a lot of imagery of letters moving. It's pretty cool. And that's an image over there. That's theopathy. Then you get the theurgy. Theurgy we're a little bit more familiar with, although not comfortable with. Theurgy is basically controlling and altering the rules of nature using divinity, using Kabbalah. What do we call this in layman's term? Magic. That's called magic, right? Using Kabbalah, it's called Kabbalah Ma'asit, practical Kabbalah, to change the world around you, right? To make things happen. Prime example of that, a golem, right? Other examples, certain forms you can imagine, all kinds of magic. The Gemara has stories about Tanayim and Amorayim doing magic. So these are not foreign ideas, but that's another form of Kabbalah. Again, usually using things like letters, writing medallions, amulets, right? Amulets used to be really, really big, right? They're not as big anymore, but they used to be really big. What's big now? The red bindle, right? Right. That's basically the closest we get nowadays. I don't know anybody who has an amulet, but they used to really, really have. 500 years ago, 300 years ago, people would go to a Kabbalist and have them write an amulet for them. I'm sure it exists nowadays, I just haven't heard of it. Okay, that's theurgy. Then you have theosophy. Now this is the most popular form that we know of Kabbalah, and the one that we're most comfortable with. Theosophy sounds like philosophy, right? Theosophy is just the philosophy of God. It's the study of divinity, the study of how God acts in the world, how God engages in the world, and how he is in the world. That's theosophy. Right? This is most of the Kabbalah that we are familiar with. It's the study, I wrote, of the topography of the spiritual worlds, which we'll get to later, of your soul, of God's nature, of the inner meaning of the Torah, of numerology, not in order to change things, but rather to understand the world, right? Gematriot. Gematriot is a form of theosophy because it says that the letters have more meaning than simply, you know, the words on the page, the pshat, right? There's a sod to the letters more than just the pshat, and the sod is important in the sense that it tells you about the world and it tells you about God. Those are the three prime forms of Kabbalah, which brings us to the next section, which is, okay, now that we understand what Kabbalah is, do we really want to continue? Is this really for us? Why would we think it wasn't? So I'll tell you two sources. These are not exhaustive by any means. And then we'll talk a little bit about why they say what they say. So the Shach, this is a very, very late source, okay? 17th, 18th century. This is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The Shach writes in Yerodea, there are those who say that one should wait until the age of 40 before learning Kabbalah, for it says in the Mishnah, 40 is the age of wisdom. Right? Who here has heard of this idea before that you have to be 40? Okay? Almost everybody. Where does it come from originally? A little bit of a mystery. The number, the actual age of 40, really not clear. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos talks about the meaning of 40 is Bina, but that doesn't say anything about Kabbalah. The age of 40 is not really clear. The truth is that before this source, there were sources of 20. Supposed to be 20. Where does the 40 come from? We're not exactly sure. It probably comes after the time of, by the way, of Shabtai Tzvi, who we're going to have to talk about later on. That was one of the warnings that people should not be engaged in Kabbalah. We'll get back to that. But either way, what the Shach is saying is that you have to have a certain amount of preparation, both in terms of age and in terms of content, right? He says you have to be familiar with Torah first. You have to be familiar with wisdom. Now, where does the Shach actually get this line from? The truth is the Shach gets this line mostly from the Rambam. And when the Rambam said it, he wasn't talking about Kabbalah. He was talking about philosophy. Rambam writes, even though he was so into philosophy, he writes himself, before you're Metayel Bapardes, now I know that Pardes to many of us means something mystical, right? But that's not what the Rambam meant when he said it. When the Rambam said it, he meant philosophy, metaphysics, the upper sciences, medieval sciences, right? And what he meant when he said that was that you should first learn Torah, first be comfortable in Torah before you get into philosophy. But it was transported into this other area. They're saying, first understand Shas, Poskim, Navi, Chumash, Mishnah, all the basic things, and then only then go into Kabbalah. That's what the Shach was saying. All right? On the other hand, it sounds like most of us wouldn't be involved. Right? If you don't know Shas, you don't know Poskim, you don't know all of Tanakh, then there's really no room for us. There are more chairs over here. Bring them to the back.
Hashem.
So, the Vilna Gaon is cited, on the other hand, in a sefer called Eben Shalema, which is not written by the Grab, but is written by his Talmidim, and is a recording of many of his sayings and many of his teachings based on primary sources, places, things that he wrote in other places. The redemption will only occur through the study of Torah. Okay, so far so good. The Geula will only come when people, through the study of Torah. That is the prime way of bringing the Geula. And we'd be fine with that if he didn't say the next line. And the main part of the redemption is dependent upon the study of Kabbalah. The main part of Kabbalah, of the Geula will be from Kabbalah. Now, there's a little bit of a caveat over here. What's the source? It says on the sheet, Tikkuni Zohar. Okay, so this is a little bit plugging yourself, right, from the Zohar. But either way, this is the Vilna Gaon, this is the Gra, right? Mipivanu Chaim, we hold of the Gra. Everybody holds of the Gra. By the way, he has a nice little Dvar Torah at the bottom over here where he explains the prayer of Ahava Rabbah or Ahavat Olam, as we say in Shul, the one from the morning. The last bracha of Birchos Kriyas Shema that we say in the morning, one of my favorite tefillot, which talks primarily about Limud Torah, L'lmod, L'lamed, L'asot, and he says over here, Mitchila, I have a typo over here, so it says first that L'lamed, L'lmod, L'lamed, V'acharkach V'ha'er Einenu, D'kayal Pnimiuta Torah. He says, first we ask God to help us learn, and then to teach, and then that he will open our eyes. Why do we need to? We already learned. Why does he need to open up our eyes? It's referring to the study of Pnimiyut HaTorah, which is another word for Kabbalah, for the inner meaning of the Torah, for a more mystical sense. So he finds that in the prayers. Okay, so the Vagra says, no, Kabbalah is an important thing to learn. So we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. On one side, we're not supposed to learn Kabbalah. On the other side, we want to bring the Geula. We have to learn Kabbalah. So let's talk about what would be the reason why we wouldn't want to learn Kabbalah. And here are some suggestions. What would be a reason why a person should not study Kabbalah? Yes. What do you mean it's dangerous? Okay. The magic stuff could be dangerous to whom? To anybody, to the person doing it, right? And to the people who he's affecting, right? Okay. Thank you very much. Anything else? Excellent. Excellent. And that would be primarily probably in the theosophy category, right? Talking about people misinterpreting things that it says in the Kabbalistic texts, which could lead to, what could it lead to? What are the dangers of misinterpretation? Kfira is certainly one danger of this misinterpretation. We'll see that when we get to the Hasidim and the concerns over there. What's another one? Avlisha ben Avuya, yes, absolutely. But another problem with the misinterpretation, you want to speak to that? Yes, go ahead. Right, certainly there's an antinomianism, another fancy word, an antinomianism to Kabbalah. Antinomianism means basically to not care about the rules, because you're kind of like only thinking about the spiritual, and you're not thinking about the physical. The mitzvot have to be done one way or another. Ner mitzvah b'Torah or. We have to worry about the mitzvot and learning Torah. But so you can't lose that inside if you're just reaching for the higher worlds. Yes?
Just as I wouldn't delve into the practice of medicine because I have no background in it, I wouldn't delve into the practice of mysticism because I have no knowledge
right.
of background in it.
You'd have to have a firm background. By the way, just getting back to the misinterpretation, there was another concern with misinterpretation. It could lead to wrong conclusions about some important things. For instance, Geula, right? Every time you find a false Messiah throughout history, Shabtai Tzvi is just one example, almost every time, it's always coming from the Kabbalah. It's always coming from some kind of prediction about Mashiach coming. It's always happening. Here's the other danger with magic. Because the Messiah, perhaps in many cases, is doing magic. Now, whether he's really doing magic or whether it's fakery, either way, he's claiming that he's using the Torah, he's using divinity in order to achieve what he's doing, right? That's the whole idea of false messiahs. They're using the Kabbalah. So that's another danger over there.
And prophets.
False prophets and false messiahs are, you know, same thing. So what's the response? So what excuse do we have? So I would suggest, and I've seen this, I would suggest that the first two, we don't have any excuse. Oh, by the way, the meditation one. There's a danger of the meditation as well. When done improperly, first of all, it could lead to kfirah. A lot of Eastern meditation is based on avodah zarah, idolatry. And so when you kind of go in that direction, that can happen. Also, if it works, right? I know there are a lot of us who are skeptical, but naniach that it works, right? These meditative practices, reportedly, I haven't experienced this, reportedly they're not good for your health, right? You look at the history of Kabbalists from the last 600 years, they all died young. All died young. Rav Arya Kaplan died before 40, the Ramchal died before 40, the Arizal died before 40. Now, I'm not, you know, suggesting a direct causality. I'm not that kind of scientist. But, you know, they say themselves that it's not a coincidence. So there is some kind of connection over there, and maybe that's another reason why we wouldn't be involved. Theosophy, however, as I said before, theosophy, the study of God in the world through the Kabbalah, is the most popular and the safest. Because you usually will have a teacher, and if you at least you know what the dangers are. You stay away from kfirah, that part at least you can kind of pull off. Anything you're not comfortable with, you back off. When you go into the other things, so then they're a little bit more dangerous. Theosophy, as I said before, is the main study of Kabbalah nowadays. That's what the Zohar is about. That's what almost all Kabbalah that people study nowadays is just academic. To understand what the Torah really means. Pnimiyut HaTorah. So we're going to stay on that level. Okay? All right. Now we get a little bit into the history. All right? So before we get to the actual books of Kabbalah, and we're going to get there, first we'll see, does it predate any of that? So we'll look at a little bit more classical sources. So the main source of most of the Kabbalistic ideas in Shas are from the Gemara in Chagiga. Gemara in Chagiga, based off the Mishnah in the second parak, I believe, mistaken, Ein Dorshin, which basically means you're not supposed to learn these things, right? Few things that Ein Dorshin, but it's Ein Dorshin Bifnei Shlosha, Ein Dorshin Bifnei Shnayim, right? You're not supposed to learn these in a group. And the things that are listed over there are basically two things that are mentioned, Maaseh Merkava and Maaseh Bereshit, Maaseh Sifre, basically Yitzira. Okay, we'll look at the English over here. It says you're not supposed to learn about the work of creation in the presence of two. Whence do we infer this? Where do you get this from? For the rabbis taught, for ask thou now the days past, one may inquire, but two may not inquire. Based on a drasha. There's a drasha that one person may ask another person, but two may not ask. Right? It's a conversation between two people, which means that the conversation is limited to two people. When it says, nor the work of creation in the presence of two, that means there can't be two students. Right? It's one teacher and one student. You can't have two students. Rav Yochanan said to Rabbi Elazar, come, I will instruct you in the work of the chariot. Okay? Note that it's a different phrase. That's Maaseh Merkava. What is the work of the chariot? Does anybody know? Yechezkel. Thank you. Or? Same thing. Six of one, half dozen of the other. Or? That's not what I was going for. Yeshayahu. Right? Perek Aleph of Yechezkel and Perek Vav of Yeshayahu are pretty much the same. It's a vision of angels, right? Of angels, which we call the Maaseh Merkava, because there is a chariot imagery over there. So the study of that is called Maaseh Merkava, the first parak of Yechezkel and the sixth parak of Yeshayahu. So Rabbi Yochanan says to Rabbi Elazar, come, let's learn a little bit of Kabbalah. Let's learn a little bit of the Maaseh Merkava. He replied, I'm not old enough. Now, how old was he? I don't know. Doesn't say. Not old enough. When he was old enough, Rabbi Yochanan died. Oh, well. Rav Asi then said to him, come, I will instruct you in the work of the chariot. Okay, you got a backup teacher. He replied, had I been worthy, I would have been instructed by Rav Yochanan, your master. And basically, it sounds like Rav Elazar never learned. Because he said, it's a siman that I wasn't supposed to learn. The fact that Rav Yochanan died before I got to. They tell a story about the Gra, that when he was 13, it's a story, when he was 13, he was going to make a golem. And then as he was getting ready to make a golem, it started to pour and lightning started to crash, and he saw that as a siman, he shouldn't do it. Right? So sometimes, when you're on this plane, that's the kind of way that you relate to the world. So, the next story is, Rav Yosef was studying the work of the chariot. Okay, Rav Yosef is learning Maaseh Merkava. The elders of Pumbedita were studying the work of creation. Maaseh Yetzirah, or Maaseh Bereshit, right? Maaseh Bereshit. These seem to be two substantially different studies, right? And we're going to see that they really are. So they're studying two different things. The latter said to the former, let the master teach us the work of the chariot. He replied, teach me the work of creation. We'll do a deal, right? student exchange program. You teach me that, I'll teach you this. After they had taught him, they said to him, so what happened? They taught him the work of creation. They said to him, let the master instruct us in the work of a chariot. Guess what happens? He replied, we have learned concerning it, honey and milk are under thy tongue. The things that are sweeter than honey and milk should be under thy tongue. Basically, the Gemara goes on in euphemism to basically say that he reneged on his part of the deal. And he did not teach them the work of the chariot, even though they had an agreement. He felt that it was too much to teach them. It wasn't right. Now, perhaps the reason he didn't teach them was there were multiple people there.
Too young?
No? Or maybe there because there were a lot of people there. Now, he could have taught each one by one, I know. But either way, he didn't end up teaching them. Apparently, the work of the chariot is on an even higher level than the work of creation. The latter, what did I get to? An objection was raised. How far does the portion of the work of the chariot extend? Rabbi said, as far as the second, and I saw. Okay, this gets into the Perek of Yecheskel to figure out where Maaseh Merkava is. Rav Isaac said, as far as Chashmal. Right? Chashmal is one of the words in the Nach that we don't know how to translate. Even though nowadays we know what it means. It means electricity. Now, it could be that that's what it means. Don't know. But Yecheskel saw Chashmal. No proper interpretation was given. I actually, by Kaplan, actually gave an interesting one, which is chash mal. What's chash? So, no. So he suggested that it means silence, right? Chashai, right? And what's mal? Chashai in Aramaic, I should explain. He saw it as Aramaic. There is Aramaic in Tanakh. He said it's chash and then mal. Chash is silence. What's mal? What? Yes. Lemalel in Aramaic is to speak. Chash means to be silent. Mal means to speak. It's the silent speech. Interesting. That's what he suggested. As far as Chashmal, as far as I saw may be taught, thenceforward only the heads of the chapters may be transmitted. In other words, the work of the chariot, right, it starts at a certain point, and up until there you can teach, and after that you're not supposed to teach. By the way, actually, no, I'm not going to go there. That's fine. Some, however, say, as far as I saw, okay, then it keeps going. Now, the next underlying part, but may one expound the mysteries of Chashmal? Can you really explain what it means? I just did. For behold, there was once a child who expounded the mysteries of Chashmal, and a fire went forth and consumed him. So even the study of Maaseh Merkava is dangerous. The case of the child is different, for he had not reached the fitting age. He wasn't old enough. How old was he? I don't know. So this child died because of it. Okay? So there you have basically Maaseh Merkava and Maaseh Bereshit or Yetzirah clearly are some kind of mystical form of study. Next section is a famous section. Our rabbis taught four men enter the garden, right? Arba nechnesu lepardes. Four of the Tanaim went into the pardes. Who are they? Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, both first names are Shimon, no relation. Rabbi Akiva, and Elisha ben Avuya, who would afterwards be known as Acher, because of what happened to him when he went into pardes. Now, what is pardes? We don't know for sure, right? But Rashi and Tosfot say that pardes is, they would use the Shemot Hashem in order to transcend, clearly a form of theopathy, meditation, in order to reach higher realms, and they saw visions. In fact, the Gemara goes on to say that they saw specifically a vision of marble, it says pure marble. There's no such thing as pure marble. It's translucent marble. Translucent marble, there's probably another name for that, which looked like water, and they were warned, don't say that it looks like water, apparently. If you ever do this, don't say that it looks like water. Okay? And each one had a different effect on each one. Ben Zoma, what happened to him? Ben Zoma actually, which one was it? Ben Zoma went crazy. He, Nitraf, he went a little bit crazy. Ben Azai died. Elisha ben Avuya went off the derech. And Rabbi Akiva was the only one who went in b'shalom and came out b'shalom. He was the only one. The Marsha explains because he didn't look too close. He tried to maintain his balance. The others all lost control of themselves when they saw what they saw. So you see, there's a danger there as well, even with the meditation. Okay, now, this can take us into the classic works of Kabbalah. There are a few major classic works of Kabbalah. We'll get to the Zohar last. Okay? The first we'll get to is the Sefer HaBahir. The Sefer HaBahir, I wrote a little bit of a introduction to the Sefer, is traditionally attributed to Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana, one of the Tanaim, right? Cited all throughout Shas. Nechunya ben Akana, who lived in 100 CE. Some scholars say it was adapted from Raza Rabba, which is just another book. It doesn't really matter to you whether it was or wasn't. And some say it's from the 10th century. It's first published in 1176, and its main subject is describing the 10 Sefirot and Theosophy. Right? The Sefirot we'll get to later, but that's its main subject. Now, how much authority does this book have? So I can tell you that of all of the books, this is, I don't want to say it that far. The Ramban, who we'll get to later, is one of the principal characters of the tradition of the Kabbalah, quotes the Sefer HaBahir left and right. It was clear that he had it in front of him. Clear that he had Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana's Sefer in front of him. Now again, as I said before, it describes the Tensurot and Theosophy. I put the beginning of the book on the page. All right, just the beginning. It's been translated. Actually, Rabbi Arya Kaplan translated the Sefer HaBahir into English, as well as Sefer Yetzirah, which we'll get to. Translated them both into English. It doesn't help. you can find them online anyways in English. You can find everything online in English. So if you really wanted to, that's where I got this from. So the first thing, each one of these books, by the way, the reason why we know who their supposed author is because it starts out that way. It's like a midrash. The book starts out with Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana said. That's how we know that he's the author, because this is his book. So he said one verse, and now they do not see light, it is brilliant. In the sky, that was a pasuk from Iyov. It's brilliant, Bahir, that's where the book gets its name from the pasuk that starts with Bahir. Round about God in terrible majesty, it's a vision of God. It's from one of the last chapters of Iyov. How do I know that's a vision of God? Because in the last chapters of Iyov, God confronts Iyov. Iyov is seeing God. He's having a vision of God. God's yelling at him. He's not very happy. And he sees a Bahir, a brilliance. And another verse says, though, that Hashem is in darkness. He made darkness his hiding place. How could it be both bright, brilliant, and dark? It is also written, cloud and gloom surround him. It's also dark. This is an apparent contradiction. A third verse comes and reconciles the two. It is written, even darkness is not dark to you. Night shines like day. Light and darkness are the same. Oh!
That's
clear. Well, how does this read, though? What does it remind you of, this kind of writing? It's a midrash, but about something else with a different kind of terminology and speaking on a different level. But it's a midrash, that's what it is, right? There's a pasuk, there's two psukim, there's a contradiction between the two psukim. They find some kind of pasuk that reconciles the two. Light and dark are the same. Now, in this case, I would suggest, given that it's Parshat Bo, might as well talk about it. Makat Choshech, there is some dispute. Is Makat Choshech darkness like the absence of light, or it's actually substance? And those that say it's a substance actually say that it's not even darkness at all. It's or. It's an or, that's a specific or. Which or is it? It's called the Or HaGanuz. Or HaGanuz, which was hidden away, which, when you look in the Mepharshim, they say, is an or which you cannot see through. And so Choshech over here doesn't really mean darkness, it just means opaqueness. You can't see through it because it's not a light that you can use with your eyes. But that's just a suggestion. I'm not saying that is the pshat. Just suggesting that's what it is, given the week that we are in. All right, we'll skip ahead to Sefer Yetzirah because we don't have a lot of time. It's a lot to do. Yes. Who wrote Anna B'Kach? Who wrote Anna B'Kach? Yes. Which is 40 letters, 40 words, 40. Yeah, it's the 40 words, I think, corresponding to the 40 letters. We're going to get to that a little bit later. Now, Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah, as well, is quoted in many of the Rishonim, so it's definitely old. Traditionally attributed to none other than Avram Avinu. All right? That's who Rav Sajagon and Rabbi Yehuda Levi, that's who they attributed it to. Right? By the way, everybody you think you know from that period of time, they're all Kabbalists. All of them. We're going to get to that soon. Although others, the Ramak of Moshe Cordovero, attributed it a little bit later to Rabbi Akiva, modern scholars have not reached the consensus, but actually in this case, they all agree that it is ancient. It goes back at least to 200 CE. All right? This is one of the cases where everybody agrees that Sefer Yetzirah is very old. Now, you can't really get around Sefer Yetzirah being at least that old. Why? Because you know who else quotes the Sefer Yetzirah, or at least doesn't quote it, but mentions it? The Talmud. Right, famous Gemara, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. On the eve of every Shabbat, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's pupils, Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Hoshaya, who devoted themselves especially to cosmogony, the study of basically something like astrology, used to create a delicious calf by means of the Sefer Yetzirah and eat it on the Sabbath. So they used to make a calf. using the Sefer Yetzirah. Right? That's what they did. What bracha do you make on that calf? Big question. No, I'm serious. It's a big question. What bracha do you make on man? Right? Really not clear. Exactly, right? Really, really not clear. Anyways, this is actually really important. It's coming out on Tu B'Shvat. What bracha do you make on hydroponic fruits and vegetables? All right, maybe we'll talk about that another time. All right, this is Kabbalah now. Now, Sefer Yetzirah, how do you translate that? The name. The Book of Creation, right? Meaning, normally when we say the Book of Creation, right, we mean the book about the creation of the world, right? There's another way of reading the title, which is that it's the Book of Creating. What did they use it for? They used it to create something, which is what the book is about. The book is about the letters, right? It's mainly about the letters that God used to create the universe, right? We know that God created the universe. This isn't Kabbalah, this is Pirkei Avos, right? Granted, it's a Brisa in Pirkei Avos. It's the sixth parak of Pirkei Avos, so it's not a Mishnah. But the Brisa tells us that God created the world in 10 utterances. The words, the letters of the Hebrew alphabet were used to create the world. Sefer Yetzirah describes that kind of thing. You look in the first section, in 2 and 30 most occult and wonderful paths of wisdom did Ka, the Lord of hosts, engrave his name, God of the armies of Israel, ever-living God, merciful and gracious, sublime, dwelling on high, to who inhabiteth in eternity. He created this universe by the three Sfarim, number, writing, and speech. It's going to describe these concepts, and they used it to create. There's another Gemara that says, I believe it says that he used the Sefer Yetzirah. The Gemara says, actually, might not. Gemara says, Rava Baragavra, right? The Rava created a man, which is a golem, right? He made a man because they wanted to make a minion. that's what he wanted, and he probably used the Sefer Yetzirah to do that. Right? They say that to make the golem, I'm not. No. They say that the finishing touch is to put the word Emet on its forehead, right? And so you use the letters in order to do it. So this is a description of using letters to create. Okay, now we get to the Heichalot. By the way, that would be Masa Yetzirah, right? That's what the Gemara in Chagig was referring to when he was talking about the work of creation. That's Sefer Yetzirah. Which leads us to the other work that we talked about before, of Masa Merkava. There are a number of very old manuscripts, very old texts, which are called the Heichalot literature. And they are all about Masa Merkava. Okay? Now, here is where you need to, if you don't understand it, it's okay, but you need to realize that there is something here that's important that we don't understand. Because the impact of this on tefillah is indescribable. All right? Let's take a look at this example. Right? So this is a set of texts produced in Talmudic times which explain the Merkava section of Nach, angels and elevations. This is based on the first parak of Yechezkel, right? I looked, and lo, a stormy wind came sweeping out of the north, a huge cloud and flashing fire, surrounded by a radiant noga, and in the center of it, the center of the fire, a gleam, chashmal, as of amber. In the center of it were also the figures of four creatures, right? And he begins to describe different kinds of angels. Sraphim, Ofanim, all these different kinds of angels. That should be already a giveaway, by the way. Seder Rabba de Bereshit, one of the Heichalot texts, okay? We're not going to read this whole thing, but we'll read a little bit and then I'll just describe what it's talking about. Rabbi Shmuel said, how beloved is Israel before the Holy One, blessed be He, blessed One, even more than the ministering angels. Man is even greater, B'nai Yisrael, greater than the angels. For when the angels want to recite songs first before making, for instance, mountains of fire or hills of flame, the Holy One, blessed One, says to them, be silent until I have listened to the songs and praises, prayers, and pleasant melodies of Israel. Right? God wants to hear us before He wants to hear the angels. As it is written, when the morning stars sang together, this refers to Israel, and all the sons of God shouted for joy, this refers to the ministering angels. We go first. And then the Midrash, right, essentially, goes on to describe the angels getting up in the morning and starting to sing. And they call to each other, and it goes one after another, different kinds of angels. When all the ministering angels and all the angels of the firmament hear the sound of the songs and praises that Israel sings below, they immediately open their mouths and in a loud voice say, holy, holy, holy. Right? Kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. When the time arrives for the angels to sing a song and melody, the angel Shmuel, okay, the great honored and awesome prince, stands at the windows of the lower firmament to listen intently to the sound of songs. And he, when he has heard them, and he let everybody else, then all the angels start to come down. It basically describes like a movie of angels coming down. Now, why do I say this is essential? Right? Take a look at davening. Just take a short look at it. You know what? Go straight to the end of davening. And what do you get to? You get to Kedusha de Sidra. Kedusha de Sidra is the part at the end. Right? Where? How does it go? Oval etzion, and then eventually, Lo yamushu mipicha mipitzarachan mitzarachan. Amar Hashem et aved olam. Ve'atak kadosh yoshev tiyisrael bekarat zel zel ve'amar. Kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. Then it explains in Aramaic. U'mekablin dein min dein ve'amrin. Right? The angels speak to each other. Kadish b'shmei merah me'ilah b'etshchintai. There's an Aramaic translation of the Hebrew text. And then Baruch Kvod Hashem Kamo. Who are we quoting? These are angels. We're actually quoting the angels. You go through the entire text of our tefillah. Left and right, we are quoting, describing angels. Right? In the Kedusha beforehand. Right? We talk about the Srafim and we talk about the Ofanim. Right? In Kel Adon, we talk about that on Shabbos. Right? It's everywhere. This stuff sounds like, you know, we don't know what it's talking about. Don't talk to me about angels. I don't know what it means. I don't understand it. I don't even know if I believe in angels. You can't not. It's in Nach. Right? Not as prominent because most of it is in Ketuvim, although in the prophets they do show up. But it's in your tefillah. You're saying these things. If you don't understand it, at least acknowledge that there's something here to understand. Right? That's why this is so important. These halachei halot texts explain these concepts which we recite daily in our tefillah. Okay, now we get to the Zohar. Now here is a story. The Zohar was published for the first time in the 1270s. Nobody ever said that it was ever published before then. You won't find anybody who ever said that there was a book called the Zohar before that, those years. Not only that, it isn't even cited by anybody. Nobody refers to a book called Zohar before the year 1270. And yet, it was published, and within 10 years, every Kabbalist knew and was citing the Zohar. It was published by a man named Moses de Leon, a Kabbalist, living in Guadalajara. He was born in 1240, died in 1305. I almost always have the dates of people. Now, as I said before, how do you know who is the author of the text? It always says at the beginning. So at the beginning of the Zohar, it says who the author is. Who's the author? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It's clear. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is the author of the Zohar. That's what it says in the Zohar. Okay? Moses de Leon publishes a book called the Zohar, which he says is authored by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Where did it come from? It says he got it. He got his hands on the manuscript. Somehow it got passed down to him. And he's decided he's going to publish it. It is by far the most comprehensive Kabbalah text that we have. It's on the whole Torah. Right? It's basically a perush. It's really a medrash. It's really a medrash on the entire Torah. None of the other texts are like that. Almost all the other texts focus on Bereshit or focus on Yecheskel. They focus on something. Zohar is on everything. There are different parts to the Zohar. Some parts are, you know, there's a book called Raya Mehemna, which is attributed to Moshe Rabbeinu. There are sections that are attributed to Adam HaRishon. There are texts that are attributed to all different kinds of people, but either way, Zohar is by far the most expansive and oft-quoted text that we have now. The question is, who wrote it? That's the big question. And then the next question, which is no less significant, is, does it matter? Now, why do I say that there is some question about who wrote it? So we'll start with the actual story of how it came to be. So as I said before, Moses de Leon published it in 1270s, I don't know exactly which year, and immediately became popular. Never been heard of before. Rav Aryeh Kaplan has in his book, this is what I'll tell you, there's a book called Meditation in the Kabbalah, an excellent, excellent book. And I was really glad to get my hands on it. My mother just brought it for me last week when she came back to Israel, because the only copy of the story that I'm about to tell you was in Hebrew, and I wasn't in the mood to translate the whole thing. We're not going to read the whole thing, but I've actually taken his translation of the story and put it through the pages. You can read it on your own. It's from a sefer called Sefer Yuchasin, which was published, I think, in the 16th century, but tells a story from the 13th century. And the story is about a person named Isaac I forgot his name. Isaac. No, I wrote it down over there. I know I wrote it down somewhere. Hold on. Either way, one of the Kabbalists from the school of Ramban. Okay, so living a few years after Ramban, he shows up at the door of the widow of Moses de Leon. He shows up in town, and he starts asking around everybody, you know, have you heard of Moses de Leon? The manuscript's gotten around. He wants to know more about it. And he basically says there's some rumor that he didn't publish it, but that he wrote it himself, Moses de Leon. So he asks about, and in the story it says that he met a few people who claimed that it was clear to them that Moses de Leon had written it himself, and that he hadn't published it. And then he met, and published it from a pre-existing manuscript. And then he met another person who said, actually, no, he really did, because the fact is that I got my hands on the manuscript, on a published version of his Zohar, and then I told him I lost it, so I asked if he could actually write me another one, and he wrote it word for word the same, which is clear that he had some kind of original manuscript. That's what the story is. So then this Isaac goes to meet the widow of Moses de Leon. That's towards the end of the story. And it's I didn't put page numbers on there, but he goes to the widow. It wasn't himself. Somebody else told him that he went to the widow, and the widow actually tells him that her husband never owned the book of the Zohar. In other words, he never had a pre-existing manuscript, and that he actually wrote it out himself. And his widow said to him, his wife said to him at the time, says, "What are you doing? Why are you not saying that you wrote the book?" And what did he answer? He answered, "If I say that I wrote the book, nobody will read it. Who am I? Nobody will read it. I'll put it in the name of Rishon Bar Yochai, and then people will read it." This is what the widow said. And she said she had no more manuscripts because they didn't have an original version of it. And so that is the story. Take it or leave it. Ravari Kaplan is skeptical, as most traditional Kabbalists. Almost all academics believe that Moses de Leon at worst wrote it from nothing. At best, and this is most likely the case, at best, he collated a lot of existing ideas into the book. Right? The stuff in there isn't outlandish, it's not wrong, and it's clear since all the Kabbalists accepted it, and it is completely accepted, right? It's clear that they didn't think that the ideas themselves were wrong. Now, here's where it gets interesting. If you open up a Chavel, we don't have a Chavel version. Dr. Chavel is the person who put out a version of the Ramban, which is the most authoritative version. It's all the footnotes on the bottom. It's the version I have at home. It's my favorite version. It's fantastic. It explains everything. The weird thing is, though, every time the Ramban quotes something Kabbalistic, which he does a lot, so Chavel will say on the bottom, he got this from the Zohar. That's impossible. Since Ramban lived 100 or so years before the Zohar was published, he never describes the Zohar. He mentions it when he quotes the Sefer Abahir. He mentions it when he quotes the Sefer Yetzirah. He never says the word Zohar about anything. He never even says that he got it from anywhere. He just says the ideas. More likely is that the Zohar got it from him. That's more likely. Now, this gets us to the second question, which is, does it really matter? The answer is not really. Not really. The truth is, it wasn't even that controversial until about 100, 200 years ago. Nobody really even cared if Rav Shimon Bar Yochai had written it or not. It was only once kind of the entire Kabbalistic enterprise came under fire from more rationalist camps and from people who didn't want to expand on the Kabbalah, that's when it became under fire. But until then, it didn't really matter whether you believed that it was actually written by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai or you didn't believe that. It didn't matter because the concepts themselves rang true. And they ring so true that they find their way into halakha. Make no mistake. Rav Yosef Karo wrote the Shulchan Aruch, we'll get to him later, right, who was a big Kabbalist himself, incorporated the Zohar into halakha. Things that we do now are incorporated into halakha. Tfilot that we say, songs that we sing, come directly from the Kabbalah. Right? Brich Shemei, which we say every Monday and Thursday, every Shabbos, every time we say the Sefer Torah out of the Ark, Brich Shemei is directly lifted from the Zohar of Vayakel. clear. That's not clear. There's nothing to dispute, right? You guys, I was going to save this for later, right? Everybody here, almost everybody here, grew up saying Bamem Avikim before Kabbalah Shabbos, right? Almost everybody here. If you turn the pages a little bit, you'll see. We'll get to it later. I don't want to do it now too much, but right in our shul, we supposedly say something else before we get to Nahar, which is called Kigavna. Kigavna comes from the Zohar of Sarshas Truma. It's straight up, right? Parts of the Zohar are in our tefillah, and nobody says boo. Now, the truth is that it wasn't just now that people started to criticize the Zohar. None other than Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden wrote a sefer called Mispachat. Sefer Mispachat. Rav Yaakov Emden lived in the 18th century. It was one of the biggest gedolim. Wrote a sefer where he outlined all the things that he thought were wrong in the Zohar and why it couldn't be written by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, including things that were anachronistic. For instance, stories, events, places that existed only after the destruction of the Second Beis Hamikdash, right? Words that are Spanish. Words that are Spanish in the Zohar, right? That's not possible, right? Mistakes in Aramaic. I heard over here, contains ritual observances which were decreed by rabbinical authorities who were born after Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. He's a Tana, right? It's relatively early. A lot of stuff happened afterwards. The Zohar mentions it. And many, many other things. Many other things. So Rav Yaakov Emden was not comfortable with the Zohar. He said there's no way that it was written by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. And many other people followed in his path. So, but at the end of the day, as I said before, it matters less who wrote it rather than the fact that it was accepted and the contents of the books.
Many places where they objected very much to introducing those pieces into the Tefillah. Until this day, I think in Bale, they don't say Blitzschmei.
Where?
In Bale, in Switzerland.
Okay.
And in many Yiddish
communities. Right, no, because it's interesting, because who inserted it into the liturgy? The Arizal. The Arizal put Blitzschmei from the Zohar into the Tefillah. And it's interesting, because these kinds of things usually Ashkenazim object to. And they didn't. The Gra, even. The Gra, the Vilna Gaon doesn't like adding anything to the Tefillah. There's a lot of things that are not in the Sidurei HaGra that most people say in Tefillah. Even he said Brich Shemei. Why? I don't can't put my finger on it. But that's the power of the Zohar. Okay. Now we'll get to some personalities and we'll go down a little bit to the ideas. All right. Here are some surprises. I think most people think that the Kabbalistic verve was kind of more on the Sephardi side. Is that accurate? Kind of comes more on the Sephardi side, right? They're the ones who do Chok Yisrael, right? Chassidim also a little bit, but Chok Yisrael is kind of the, nowadays you have a lot of different versions of Torah, a dose of Torah a day, things of learning each day, right? So Chok Yisrael is the Sephardi version, where they learn a piece of Chumash, a piece of Mishnah, a piece of Gemara, and a piece of Zohar, every single day, right? That's, people tend to think that that's on the Sephardi side. There's a whole group of people called the Hasidei Ashkenaz. All of the Ashkenazi Balei Tosfot and Rishonim that we all know and love were almost all mystical. Almost all. Okay? Starts with Eliezer HaGadol. Eliezer HaGadol, you have stories about, and this comes from a book called Peering Through the Lattices by Rabbi Ephraim Karnervogel, Dr. Ephraim Karnervogel from YU. Actually, I happen to know that one of the last books Rabbi Beller was reading was a book about the Balei Tosfot by Rabbi Karnervogel. He was really enjoying it. So every time I look at the book, I always remember that, because I saw him reading it in his house. This Rabbi Elazar Gadol, it tells all kinds of stories about him. Now, here's an interesting thing. He has an interesting minhag. Tell me if this sounds familiar. A prominent ancestor of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid was the source of a number of liturgical and ritual interpretations and customs. Among them is the practice of the Passover Seder presented by Rabbi Elazar of Worms of repeatedly dipping a finger in the cup of wine and releasing 16 drops. Okay, so we were with him until the 16, but what is the classic reason for our custom for the drops? What does everybody say? For the Makkod, because we feel bad, right? That's what they say, that's what the Abar Banel says. So this is a very, very similar custom, but look at what he says the reason for it is. According to Rav Elazar, this practice was transmitted by Rav Elazar Gadol and his household to subsequent calamities. Okay, some who had not received this tradition were apparently unsure of its authenticity and purpose. So he understood that it's a means of summoning or conjuring the 16-sided avenging sword of the Almighty. Ashkenaz! This divine sword could diminish the powers of pestilence and other mazikin that were represented by the 16 times the word dever is mentioned in the book of Jeremiah. All right? So that's for one. All right, you keep going. On the other side of the page, what was a good one over here? Yeah. Like the third paragraph. In the Parma manuscript passage, Petichat HaLev connotes the ability to understand Torah teachings clearly and recall those teachings effortlessly. There's a manuscript that described the writing of a request formula, basically what do you call that? Not a conjuration, incantation, right? But written on a well-boiled egg that was determined to have been the first ever laid by a hen, and the recitation of the adjuration that was directed to the Sar HaTorah, as well as the Sar HaPanim, not to be confused with the Sar HaPanim, and by eating the egg. These procedures and the angels to whom they are directed reflect known concepts and figures within the Hachalot literature, though the precise application of the Ashkenazic text at the hand constitutes a partial synthesis of different Hachalot rituals. Okay? These are Ashkenazim, Hasidei Ashkenaz, who are engaging in theurgy, right, in magic, in ways of using the Kabbalah to affect the world. Okay. But you've never heard of Rabbi Elazar HaGadol, right? So it's not such a big deal. Rashi was himself familiar with mystical traditions on divine names and with a number of esoteric texts and magical and theurgic techniques. Now the name part we know. Rashi actually talks about the 72-letter name in Parshas Beshalach. And we know he talks about Moshe killing the Egyptian with the Shem HaMeforash. But he says here that he would even engage in theurgic techniques. In his Talmudic commentary to Tractate Sukkah, Rashi produces a scriptural derivation for the divine name of 72 letters that is found in Sefer Abahir. Right? So he's quoting Sefer Abahir as well. He also mentions things from the Sefer Yetzirah. This is Rashi himself. And while we don't really have a record of Rashi engaging in theurgy, he describes a lot of theurgy, a lot of magic based in Gemaras, based on Midrashim, that the Tanaim and the Amoraim engaged in, right? He was aware of this kind of thing, and he would teach about it. He would talk about it. His students learned it from him. Okay. So it really starts with them, the Hasidei Ashkenaz. All right. Then we get a little bit further, and we get to Isaac the Blind and the Ramban. These are the ones that I mentioned. Now, who's Isaac the Blind? So Isaac the Blind is a grandson, the son of the Ra'avad. Okay? The Ra'avad, I'm talking about the Ra'avad that we all know. The Ra'avad was the one who wrote the major glosses on the Rambam. Sefer Rambam, the biggest philosophical work in Judaism ever, right? The biggest philosopher ever, and somebody is critiquing his work, not from the perspective of Kabbalah, although you can find a little bit of that in there, and his son is one of the biggest Kabbalists ever. He's described as the father of Kabbalah by none other than Rabbeinu Bachaye, right? One of the other great major Kabbalists, Isaac the Blind, a son of the Ra'avad himself. He is a student of the Ramban. Now we get to the Ramban. The Ramban was a master of everything. Philosopher, Kabbalist, Talmudist, Parshan par excellence. I remember I had Rebbeim that said, almost all of the Rishonim, if you look at books that quote those Rishonim, they always talk trash with each other. It's a lot of trash talk amongst the Rishonim. You're an idiot, nothing you say is right, this is wrong, they make fun of each other's names. All bets are off. Nobody ever makes fun of the Ramban. You won't find it. If you can find somebody making fun of the Ramban, you bring it to me, I'll give you 100 shekel. 100 shekel, you find somebody actually making fun of the Ramban, actually messing with the Ramban, you won't find it. Nobody messes with the Ramban. Interesting thing. Now, his commentary on Chumash is one of the first commentaries to actually bring in Kabbalistic ideas. So he's somewhat guilty for the proliferation of Kabbalah. Now, I say guilty because he himself, as we're going to see, was actually trying to stem the tide. He didn't want Kabbalah to become in the public domain. This is from his introduction to the Torah. He says, I exhort strongly and give solid proper advice to anyone showing interest in this book not to engage in rational reasoning or thoughts when it concerns my Kabbalistic glosses. For I emphatically inform him that my words cannot be grasped by any logic or rational understanding except by the mouth of a trustworthy wise man. basically he says, you cannot understand the Kabbalistic portions of my book unless you have a teacher. You can't just figure things out. There's no way. That, we should have said this at the beginning. Where does the word Kabbalah come from? It's received, right? That's the difference between science and Kabbalah. Science can be derived. You can derive it from the universe, right? Math can be figured out on its own, right? You can go from first principles. You can't do that with Kabbalah because it describes things that humans have no way of knowing. The only way you could know is if you were told by somebody who learned it from somebody who learned it from somebody who got it from, I don't know, God, Ruach HaKodesh. Right? That's the source of this information. So the Ramban says, don't read my book and then try to figure out, oh, maybe he means this or he means that. Don't try to do that. Now, if you have a version that on the bottom tells you what all the things mean, then you're in luck if you want to do that. The art school version of the Ramban, I actually know the person who did this. He passed away a few years ago, tragically. Rav Yaakov Blinder. I remember talking to him about this. Art school published English translation of the Ramban, just like the English translation of Rashi. It's very good. The only problem, it's not a problem if you feel the way that art school did, is that every time he got to a part that was Kabbalistic, they stopped. They left the Hebrew in, but the English, it just says, here, the Ramban starts to describe esoteric concepts that we aren't going to translate. That's what they were told by the Gedolim, who said that they should translate the Ramban. They went to discuss it. Should we translate the Kabbalistic concepts into English? They were told no, so he didn't. He just left them out. Now, it's interesting, because in the Chavel version that he translated into English, everything's in there. Now, it's not explained. It's hard to read. It's like Sansino. But everything is actually there if you actually want to see it. If you just want to read it in English, you can read it in English. There's no explanation there, but you can read it if you want. So the art school just stops. And what he says is that do not have anything to do with the hidden Kabbalah. Now, there is Kabbalah in there. I'll give you a couple of examples right at the beginning of the Torah. Od yesh biyadenu Kabbalah shel emet, I'm in the Hebrew, ki kol ha-Torah kula shmotav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One of the most important concepts that the Ramban gave to us, the idea that the entire Torah is a big name of God. The whole thing is a big name of God. Shatibot mitchalkot v'shemot binyan echad kiilu v'tachshov al derech mashal ki pasuk bereshit yitchalek l'tevot kegon berosh yitbarei. You can rewrite Bereshit Bara into Barosh Yitbare. And that's kind of a cute example. He doesn't mean that if you just kind of like move the words over. He means it's also scrambling. You could scramble the words, scramble the letters, but it's all the same because it's all the name of God. The letters are the name of God. And he says, how strong is this concept? It even has halachic implications. He says, for this reason, if there's a single letter missing from the Torah, even if it's an insignificant letter, it passes the Torah. Now, you might say, come on, the story is the same, everything is the same, I get it, the Torah is holy, but what does it matter if there's a vav missing from Aharon? Right? You can read the word Aharon without the vav. What comes along the Ramban and says, doesn't matter, that's part of the name of God. You're missing a letter. If the Torah can be re-scrambled and refigured in a different way, then that vav is important. Now, those who accept the Ramban basically say that...
variation.
Yeah, I'm not going to... Okay, those who accept the Ramban, the Shakas Aryeh says that basically all our Sifrei Torah are Pasuk. That's not a completely accepted opinion. But those who accept the Ramban, that's the logical conclusion. Because we have differences, variations between texts. It can't be that they're all okay. Either way, it doesn't matter. I don't want to go down that road right now. So that's one Kabbalistic concept. Another Kabbalistic concept, right on the first Pasuk in Bereshit, he explains that Bereshit has a lot of Ramazim, right? Rashi gives us the Ramazim based on regular Midrashim. Reshit is Yisrael, Reshit is Torah, right? He says, Reshit Tirmozki Be'eser Sfirot Nivraha Olam. Whoa. I ain't Sefer Yetzirah. He says, in the first Pasuk, you have a reference to the Sfirot, which we're going to get to in a few minutes. We have a reference to the Sfirot. It's pretty crazy. Right? He puts that as his interpretation of the Torah, a Kabbalistic concept. Nobody had done that before. Nobody does that. So that's Ramban. By the way, a lot of other Kabbalistic concepts find their way into the Ramban that if you don't know what he's talking about, then you don't know what he's talking about. I'll give you one example. In Sefer Iyov, right? In Sefer Iyov, what's the book of Iyov about? The book of Iyov is something happens to Iyov, he has a really, really hard time, and then his three friends come, and they try to convince him why, I don't know, he deserves it, this is the way the world works. They try to console him, he's not consoled. That's what most of the book is, until you get to about the 30th chapter. In the 30th chapter, a fourth person shows up, out of nowhere. Fifth, if you count Iyov. His name is Elihu. Elihu comes in, and he starts talking. He finishes and nothing happens. Eov doesn't actually disregard Elihu. So for all intents and purposes, Elihu might be right. Now Hashem comes in afterwards, and Hashem's definitely right. But Elihu doesn't seem to be wrong because nobody's disagreeing with him. Question is, what did he say? It's not clear what Elihu said that would have satisfied anybody. According to the Ramban, you know what Elihu said? Very simple. Elihu said to Eov, Eov, you deserve it. Not for anything you did in this life, but for something you did in a previous life, called Sod Ha'ibur, the idea of Gilgulim. Gilgulim for the Ramban is essential. It's a Kabbalistic concept. He uses it to describe a lot of things throughout Tanakh. He used it as a tool for understanding Chumash and Nach. It was a valid approach to philosophical questions that arise from the text. Okay. Of Avram Abu Lafia, we referred to him before. This is a person who was very, very controversial at the time. We're not going to spend too much time on him, but his main contribution was about letters and meditation. The Rashba did not like Rav Abu Lafia. I put the text over here. He does not have nice things to say about him. Because he, A, did not like the things he was saying, but also even more than that, he did not like the fact that he was basically revealing the secrets of Kabbalah to the whole world. All right, I don't want to spend too much time on that. Let's skip to the next page, which is finally getting to Tzfat. What?
Disgusting
creature. Yeah. I told you they trash trash. Tzfat. Now, when we get to Tzfat, the world explodes. Okay? This is where Kabbalah really, really takes on, just gets a turbo boost. The first Kabbalist in Tzfat, the one who taught most of the rest of the Kabbalists, was named Ramosha Kodavero, right? 1522 to 1570. He wrote a few Sfarim, Tomer Dvorah, Pardes Rimonim. And he started to fuse, one of the things he did was he started to fuse morality and Kabbalah. And he started to talk a lot about the concept of Sfirot. I have the Sfirot over here. This is from Rav Arya Kaplan. Actually, the Shemot Hashem were on here, which I removed because I didn't want to print it and have everybody walking around with Shemot Hashem over here. This book is filled with Shemot Hashem. You can't take it into the bathroom. I'm losing my voice. Okay. So the Sfirot. We'll go through them in detail. Not in detail, but we'll go through them in a minute. But the idea over here, the idea of the Sfirot, what is the idea of the Sfirot? So the best explanation that I ever saw or heard was that, we haven't talked about this yet, one of the main imageries of Kabbalah is that of light. Light is the main metaphor of Kabbalah. And the idea is divine light being filtered into our world. And it, as it goes into our world, it goes through the Sfirot. What are the Sfirot? As a metaphor, the Sfirot are kinds of lenses, right? When you have a light coming through, every time it comes through a lens, what happens to the light? It changes in a certain way. One of the ways that it changes is it changes color sometimes. A lens has the ability to change the color. Rav Moshe Kodavero was the one who color-coded the Sfirot. So each one of the Sfirot was corresponded to a different color. I didn't put it on here. It's not essential. But that was the metaphor that he used in order to understand what it meant. And what I mean for us, what it means is that the Sfirot are ways of understanding how God acts in the world. Right? God is God. He is what He is, and He's not divisible. Right? That's what we believe. Hashem Echad, Shmo Echad. He's not divisible. But the way that He acts in our world, we know is divisible. The Chumash describes Him as different things. Right? He's a man of war in some places. He's merciful in other places. He's all different kinds of things. Sometimes described as feminine, sometimes described as masculine. How do we understand that? The idea is that we're describing the way that He acts in the world. The Sfirot are like that. Okay, that's the best metaphor that you can give for the Sfirot. You have over here, the main seven Sfirot are on the bottom. Ones that everybody are familiar with. Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet. Right? Chesed is love, giving. Vura is strength, which is restricting, which is holding back. Then Tiferet, or Emet, right, that we know from Yaakov, is the fusion of the two. That's beauty. Then there's Hod and Netzach. And then there's Yesod and Malchut. We live in a world connected to Malchut. Malchut is at the bottom of the pole. Right? Now the three at the top, Keter, Bina, and Chochmah, aren't talked about so much when we talk about the Sfirot, because they're kind of in a different world. We'll get to what that means hopefully in a few minutes. But those are the Sfirot. I think one of the other lectures will go more in depth into the Sfirot. But I do want to mention when now that we get to the Arizal, right? The Arizal, the Ari, Rav Yitzchak Luria. One of his most famous teachings is called the Shvirat HaKelim. Right? Any movie that ever quotes Kabbalah always talks about the breaking of the vessels. That's the only thing they know. It's the only thing they know, the breaking of the vessels. So what is that? What is the breaking of the vessels? So we have a description here from Arya Kaplan, and basically the idea is that when God created the world, he wanted to let his light into the world. So he was going to let the light pour into the world, and it was supposed to go into these sfirot, which are basically like kelim, they're vessels. What happened is that there was an overflow, and they broke the vessels, and the light spilled out, and spilled out into the world, and it started to get basically encrusted with klipot, which with peels, right? Things that are covering the light. And our job is to scrape off those klipot and get the light back into the kelim. That's our job, to be metaken olam b'malkut shakai. That's what the phrase means. The original phrase of tikkun olam was tikkun olam b'malkut shakai. Where did they get from? We say it every day. In Aleinu, right? That's the original phrase before it got co-opted by liberal Judaism. Okay. Now he goes into where the reference in the Midrash is to the breaking of the kelim. It has something to do with Malchei Edom. I don't want to get into that right now. But it's our job to basically, the other metaphor that I saw is that, you know, if you imagine the light is water, right? The light is water and it's coming in to the in through the pipes, right? What happens when everything's working? It's great. But what happens when a pipe bursts? So the water comes flowing out and everything starts to get messed up. That's our world. That's our world. Our world is in galut. Our world has a siluk ha-shechina. The shechina is not as strong as it should be. His light isn't getting filtered in correctly. It's getting corrupted as it comes into the world. And it's our job to try to fix it. Now we get the kigavna. The other thing that happened in Sfat is that there was a tremendous, tremendous focus on Shabbat. Shabbat captured the imagination of the Sfat Kabbalists like nothing else in Judaism. What was written in Tzfat? L'Chadodi. Who wrote it? Rav Shlomo Alkabetz. Rav Shlomo Alkabetz. He's famous for writing two things. L'Chadodi and the sefer called Manot HaLevi on Megillat Esther. Those are the only things that anybody knows. Now, what's L'Chadodi about? So, the source for L'Chadodi, really, is actually Gemara in Shabbat. The Gemara in Shabbat on Daf Kuf Yud Tet describes that even in the times of the Amoraim, they used to go out to the fields to welcome the Shabbat. That's what the Kabbalists in Sfat used to do. They would go to the fields, right? They didn't just go to the Yad HaBanim. They would go to the fields in order to welcome in the Shabbos queen. And that's what the song is based on. I'll just go through a little bit of it. I actually had a rabbi in yeshiva who wrote his dissertation for college on L'Chadodi. And I actually contacted him this week to see if he had a digital copy. He said he doesn't, which is unfathomable to me. And the only copy he has is printed, and it's 150 pages. We didn't get a chance to discuss it, but I listened to a shiur, so I could remember some of the things that he said. Just to give you a couple of highlights of the Kabbalistic overtones in L'Chadodi. So first of all, as Gina mentioned before, right? Ana B'Koach was written by the author, by Nechoni Ben Akari. It's got 40 words corresponding to the 40 letter name of God. L'chadodi, the first phrase, which is the phrase that we repeat over and over. L'chadodi likrat kala pnei Shabbat nekabalah. If you count the letters in that first phrase, what do you get? There's two sides to the phrase. L'chadodi likrat kala. If you count the letters in L'chadodi likrat kala, do you know what you get? 15. If you count the letters in pnei Shabbat nekabalah, do you know what you get? 11. 15 plus 11 is 26. Yud-ke, Vav-ke. Yud-ke is 16. Vav-ke is 11. The first line and the line that we repeat over and over is a reference to the 26th letter name of God. The truth is that if you go beforehand, some of the other Prakim of Tehillim, you'll find the 72 letter name of God. So you went from 72, 40, now it's 26. Right? And which is really, by the way, 26 is the Gematria, which is the 4 letter name of God, really. That's the first phrase. Now, what's the meaning of L'Chadodi? I wanted to just do a little bit of this with you. What's the meaning? What's going on in this song? So, you have two characters here. L'Chadodi likrat kala, p'nei Shabbat nekabala. Who are the two characters? The Dodi and the kala. Who is the kala? Shabbat, thank you. Shabbat, right? Shabbat. Malchita, right? The queen. Shabbos queen. Who's Dodi? God? God should meet Shabbos? We are? Okay. We are is definitely Pshat, right? Pshat, the Pshat level is always understood as us because we're the ones going out to greet the queen, right? We're going out to greet the Shabbos queen. But what's really going on the deeper level, Dodi here is Tiferet. What does that mean? Tiferet, not the person. What's going on? If you go back to the Sefirot, right? You have in the middle line over there, you have, from the bottom, you have Malchut to Yesod to Tiferet to Keter. All right? Now, Malchut and Yesod are very much connected. I didn't mention this. I should mention it now. We're not going to go too deep in the Sefirot, I said before, but the Sefirot are actually supposed to be, in a way, almost the body of God. In what sense? It's a metaphor, but the body goes like this. All right? The top row, Bina, Keter, and Chochma, all have to do with thinking. That is the head of God. The Keter goes on the top. Right? Bina and Chochma are both thinking. Those are the mind of God. Right brain, left brain, if you will. Male and female as well is a very, very common metaphor in Kabbalah. Chochma being the male, Bina being the female. And then you keep going and you get Chesed and Bura. Those are the arms of God. Right hand and left hand. Okay? Right hand is the Gvura, left hand is the Chesed. Then you have Tiferet. Tiferet is the torso. Actually, I switched that. I think it's Chesed is the right hand and Gvura is the left hand. It doesn't matter right now. Then you have Tiferet. Tiferet is the torso, kind of where it all comes together, right? And then you have Netzach and Hod, which are the legs. And then you have Yesod and Malchut, which is the sexual organs. And each one corresponds to the male and the female. The female is the Malchut. The male is the Yesod. But they're connected. In that sense, they're part of the same part of the body. Right? Now, going back to Lecha Dodi. The Kala is connected to Malchut and Yesod. That's our world. That's the lowest part. That's where these upper worlds connect to the lower world. The Kala is that. The Dod is the Tiferet. The Kabbalists believed that because of the Shvirat Kelim, right, the world is filled with Galut. It's terrible. The Shechina is in Galut for 6 days. But only for 6 days. The seventh day was different. Seventh day was special. On the seventh day, there was a chance to bring things back together. It's Me'ein Olam Haba, right? Keep two Shabbatot. We can bring the Geula. Seventh day is different. On the seventh day, we start to say, let's start to bring things back together. The Dod and the Melech and the Malchut should come back together. Lecha Dodi Likrat Kala. Come rejoin the Kala. Reunification is the theme over here. You go to the first paragraph of the Chadodi, you don't have it. Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. What is that? Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. Well, it's a reference to the fact that Shamor and Zachor are in the first Dibrot and the second Dibrot are the references to Shabbat. I'll go a little bit late. It's okay. We always go a little bit late. Maariv is at 10. We'll be all right. Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. But it's more than that because Shamor is a reference to the Isurei Shabbat, the Malachot of Shabbat, which definitely apply without a doubt, to everybody, to males and to females. Zachor, however, is a reference to the positive mitzvot of Shabbat, which technically should really only apply to the men, because it is a positive mitzvah that is time-bound, right? Which don't typically apply to women, except it doesn't. Kiddush, which is the prime positive mitzvah on Shabbat, applies to women equally as it does to men. The Gemara explains why. Because Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. Basically, what happens is that on Shabbat, the male and the female are reunified, are brought back together. Shamor v'zachor b'dibur achad. By the way, it's not a coincidence that zachor sounds a lot like zachar. Shamor v'zachor b'dibur achad. Hishmianu kela miyuchad. Hashem echad u'shemo echad. Hashem and his shame become echad. How do you spell Hashem's name in the Torah, the one that we're talking about? Yukevavke. And how do you say it? Hadoshem, right? We don't say it like Yukevavke. Hashem, which is himself, and his shame, which is different because the way that we say it and the way that it's written are different, become one. When you go up a higher level, that's Tiferet and Malchut being combined. L'shem u'l'tiferet v'l'tila. The shame and the Tiferet will be joined together. The whole song is about this. Now, if you turn back a page, Oh, you didn't really turn the page. Kigavna. How does Kigavna start? Does anybody ever pay attention to the words? So I took the English from the art school. Look how it starts. Just as they all six Sfirot or emanations, unite above in oneness, so she, the sphere of kingship, unites below in the secret of oneness, so that it may join those above. What is Kigavna about? It's about taking Malchut, and bringing it and unifying it with everything else. This is what the Arizal was all about. The Arizal was all about reunifying Yichudim, right? The Shem Yichud Kutcher before, although it comes from the Arizal, and it was really taken on by the Hasidim, but the whole idea was to reunify, to bring all the Sfirot back together and to fix everything. We mentioned Brich Shmei. Yedid Nefesh is another song. We open up Shabbos with it, and we end Shabbos with it. Also a very Kabbalistic song. It is the only piyut that we have. I can't say that I've studied them all, but this is what I heard from somebody who knows. It's the only piyut that we have that typically, how can you tell who the author is of a piyut or a zemer? From the acrostic, right? What's the acrostic in Yedid Nefesh? It's Yud Kei Vav Kei. It's the only one. There's no other one. There's no other one. There's a story that says that the Yedid Nefesh and Baruch She'amar were came down on, like on a petek from Shamayim. I don't know where the story comes from. Came down from Shamayim directly on a petek. It was the fact is that it was published in the 16th century by Rav Elazar Azikri, the author of the Sefer HaCharedim, which has nothing to do with Charedim. Was also a Kabbalist, and there's a lot of Kabbalistic ideas in there as well. We have a few minutes left. I do want to do a little bit more, if you don't mind. After the Tzfat explosion, then you have Chassidut. Chassidut really we'll skip the Maharal. Started by the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov didn't write much, and he didn't even start Chassidut, really. His student, the Magid of Mezrich, was the one who really started to start Chassidut. He's the one who had Chassidim. Right? The Baal Shem Tov didn't have Chassidim. The Magid of Mezrich, or at least he didn't have Rebbe, he didn't have Admorim. The Magid of Mezrich was the one who kind of started to teach people who would become Rebbes. Now, one of the things that the Baal Shem Tov did teach us was about Tefillah, that he taught us about the four worlds. Right? We have the Sfirot, and these Sfirot correspond to four worlds. Asiya, Yitzira, Beria, and Atzilut. That's going from bottom up. We live in the world of Asiya. And he says that when we recite the Korbanot at the beginning of Tefillah, we are trying to kind of rectify the world of Asiya. Then we go up a level to Yitzira, which is the next world, when we start saying Pesukei Dezimra. Then when we get the Shema, we start to enter the world of Beria. And then finally, when we get to the Amidah, that's already Atzilut, which is the highest level of the Sfirot. That's the Keter, Chachma, and Bina. Alright. Now, here is where things start to get a little bit dicey. The Hasidim are going around teaching Kabbalah to everybody. Now, it is a kind of a watered down version of Kabbalah, not going all the way deep, kind of using it as a perush on Chumash to inspire people to be moralistic and to understand things on a deeper level, not really the theurgic stuff. The magic stuff in the meditation, although you have a little bit of that in Breslov. But they started to really, really expand, and they started to focus on it. One of the things that we were concerned about before, focusing on that at the expense of other things, right? The Hasidim are the ones, right, who don't know what time it is when it's time for Kriyat Shema, right? Why? What are they doing? What? Where did it start that Hasidim don't care about Zman Kriyat Shema and Zman Tehillah? Where did that start? They just don't care? No, they're busy preparing. They're busy preparing for tefillah. And they think that the preparation, this is what they say, the preparation is so important, it's more important than zmanim. It takes me time to get into the right mindset to say Shema. And if that means that I miss Zman Kriyat Shema, so be it. This is exactly the kind of thing that the Mitnagdim came out against, because it was antinomian. Now, the Gra was the kind of head Mitnaged, right? His student, Rav Chaim of Alajin, was already kind of starting a rapprochement with, I don't even know if I pronounced that correctly, with the Hasidim. The ayah had already died out. But he wrote a book called the Nefesh HaChaim, which is probably the most popularly studied book of Kabbalah in yeshivot nowadays. Almost every yeshiva studies the Nefesh HaChaim. Nefesh HaChaim is made up of four sha'arim. The first sha'ar is basically an introduction to Kabbalah. The second one is Kabbalah in Tefillah. The third one is the idea of Tzimtzum, which we didn't even have time to talk about. And the fourth one, which is what the yeshivot concentrate on, is about Torah. And the book of Nefesh HaChaim is basically introducing people to the idea that their effect on the world through mitzvot, and Torah is invisible, but extremely powerful. The act of doing a mitzvah is like pulling on the shades in Shemayim and pulling them open. And the act of doing an Avera is the opposite. It's pulling them closed. And it doesn't matter whether you're doing something wrong, you're talking about something wrong, or you're even thinking about something wrong. In the mind of the Nefesh, in the book of the Nefesh HaChayim, thinking about doing something wrong is even worse than doing something wrong. Because machshava reaches a higher level than maaseh. Thought is more powerful than even action. These are concepts that he develops. But in the fourth shar, he starts to pull back and he says, the truth is, I really shouldn't be writing about this. We shouldn't be writing about this in public. But I see that it's gotten out already and people are talking about it. So I wanted to set things straight. Because the problem is, and this is under bolded somewhere, I don't have time to find it right now, the problem is that people take the ideas that they think they understood from Kabbalah and they teach it to people who are ignorant. And those people come up with wrong ideas about God. And this is kind of funny, the example that he gives. It's funny because it sounds trivial, but I think it's just symptomatic. He says, for instance, if you believe, the way that some of the Hasidim do believe, and the Gra had a big problem with this, that God is imminent in the world in the sense that there's God in this table, which is called panentheism. Panentheism. There's something called pantheism, which is what Spinoza believed, which is that this table is God. There really is nothing else that is God except this table and the world and nature is God. That is God. There's nothing. There is no think of something beyond that. The world is God. Hasidim didn't believe that. They believed in something called panentheism, which is subtly different, which is that there is God. God is transcendent, but he's also immanent. He's also in everything. And his essence is in everything. The Nefesh HaChaim said, if you believe that, you know what it means? It means that if he's in this table, he's also in the books. You know where else he is? He's also in the bathroom. Which means that when you go to the bathroom, you can think about God, because he's there also. This is the example that he gives. He says, if you Chas V'Shalom come to believe this, you're going to come to thinking about God in the bathroom. Now, don't know how prevalent that was. I don't know. But his idea is that that's kfirah, right? It doesn't matter whether you think about God in the bathroom or not. It's kfirah. The Gra was vociferously against this, and his students were as well. They believe that it's not God in the table, but there is God's hashkacha. His control is in the table. There's a presence of God here, but it's not God himself. It's not his essence. See, we're running out of time. So I have to bring it a close somewhere. I was hoping we would have more time. Okay, I guess we'll end with the modern Kabbalah. Modern times, right? You go to L.A., right? The Kabbalah Center. So I did a little bit of research on this. The truth is, it's not easy. You go online. I watched a few YouTube videos. And I was thinking, you know, there must be something in there. So I have to be honest. There's... at least not what I could see without paying. There's a paywall there. The YouTube videos that are online sound like any self-help book you can buy on a bookshelf in Barnes & Noble. It's all about how light, you have to bring the light in, and you have to transform yourself. I didn't hear anything. I heard astrology. One of them was talking about how she's a Gemini, and if you're a Gemini this, then that. If you open up any horoscope book, I'm sure you can find the exact same things. Now, it could be that if you pay, then you get to see the videos where they, you know, go a little bit deeper, and then maybe you can get a red bindle. I don't know. I did see that it appeared that they had a big mass Rosh Hashanah service that was videotaped with microphones and everything. So I don't know about that. I don't know whether it took place on Rosh Hashanah or not. I couldn't tell, but it was weird. People were wearing talisim, and it was weird. And so that's what I saw. Now who comes out against this? The truth is that this kind of thing exists in Israel as well. It's a tshuva, the last thing on the page, in the sheets. There's a tshuva from Rav Avadya Yosef. And he was asked, what does he think about the Kabbalah Center sprouting up in Israel, of institutions that would be teaching Kabbalah to the masses. And he is not happy. First of all, he says, anybody who's not married shouldn't be learning Kabbalah. And you have to be at least over 20. So you see, he has over 20, he doesn't have it over 40. But he ends up, the whole thing he says at the end, he says, first of all, when you learn Kabbalah, you have to learn it from a teacher. And the teacher should be of the highest caliber. The person should be like a malach. If you don't have a malach for teaching Gemara, you should definitely have a malach for teaching Kabbalah. And he says, most of the times, that's not what's going on. These people are taking money. That's kind of like a red flag. And so, definitely should not be engaged in these kinds of things. The kinds of popular learning of Kabbalah. Okay, we're going to stop there. Just to recap everything that we did, we talked about what Kabbalah was. Three spheres of Kabbalah. We talked about whether it's really for us, and then we kind of went forward anyways, no matter what. The dangers of Kabbalah in terms of magic, meditation, false messiahs, misunderstandings. We talked about the Gemara, talks all about concepts that show up in the Gemara, and even refers to books that we have that are Sifrei Kabbalah, Sefer Yetzirah, Sefer Abahir. The Zohar is not mentioned, and the Sifrei Hechalot. The Zohar itself is of questionable authorship, but again, it doesn't seem to matter. People will quote it, and people will use it, and we use it daily, despite who the author is. Doesn't really matter, although it's very, very interesting food for thought. The great Mekubalim throughout history, starting from the beginning of the last millennium, really, it's filled. All the people that you know and love are all Kabbalists, or all have mystical inclinations. From the Hasidic Ashkenaz, even Rashi and his Talmidim, to the Ramban, obviously. We talked about Rav Avraham Abulafia, not so much. And then finally we got the Tzfat, the Ramak, Rav Moshe Kodavero, the Arizal, Rav Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch. We didn't have time to talk about it. He has a book called the Magid Meisharim, wherein it's a recording of all the things that the Malach came to tell him. Right? This is the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Has a book like that. Shlomo Altabes, L'Chadodi, the idea of Lurianic Kabbalah, which is an attempt to fix the world. By the way, that was the main shift of the Arizal. It wasn't just a matter of studying Kabbalah, studying theosophy, or even a matter of doing magic or meditating or things that were personal. It was rather universal. It was trying to fix the world. That's what Lurianic Kabbalah was. Then we got to Shabbos and all the themes on Shabbos. And then finally we got to Chasidut versus Hitnagdut, the Nefesh HaChayim, the Chasidim, and their battle for the future of Kabbalah. And then finally we ended with a tiny little bit of the modern day Kabbalah. Is the Ashlag Rebbe, is he confirmed that he's coming or no? Not confirmed, but his ancestor, Yehuda Ashlag, the Kabbalah Center, basically they claim his name. Right? They say that he is the founder of their movement. He didn't have anything to do with them. He lived a long time before it. What Yehuda Ashlag did was he translated the Zohar to English. Into Hebrew. I apologize. The Zohar was translated into Hebrew, as my father likes to say, a story that he tells all the time. One time a person stopped my father in school, another teacher, stopped my father, and he asked my father, and we'll end with this, can you teach me Hebrew? So my father said, why do you want to learn Hebrew? He says, because I want to learn the Zohar, so I want to learn Hebrew. So my father said, well, I have bad news for you. First of all, the Zohar is written in Aramaic, not in Hebrew. And second of all, even if it was written in Hebrew, you wouldn't understand it. So he didn't just translate the Hebrew, he wrote a Perush as well, so to make it understandable, which definitely helped people who wanted to understand the Zohar. Ad kan! Shkoyach! Shkoyach!